Hello, welcome to 5 Things You Didn't Know, But Now You Do. I'm your host, Angela Betancourt, and I'm thrilled you joined me this week. Thank you for tuning in. I'm really excited about our guest today, Sally Curley. Sally is the founder and CEO of Curley Global IR, an investor relations, environmental social governance survey, and corporate governance strategic advisory firm. I'll link to that on the website. With more than 30 years of business experience, Sally has worked for and represented companies in the healthcare, high tech, software, and retail industries. From 2010 to 2017, she was named a top IR officer in her industry by Institutional Investor magazine. For nearly a decade, Sally served as Senior Vice President, Investor Relations for Cardinal Health, a Fortune 50 global healthcare services company, where she was a member of the global leadership team and oversaw the company's worldwide IR efforts. Sally co-founded and co-chaired the company's first cross-functional committee responsible for assessing and advancing ESG, which is environmental social governance, as we just heard, initiatives. Prior to Cardinal Health, Sally was Vice President Investor Relations for Genzyme Corporation, now Sanofi, where the 9 years she led Global IR and helped to advise its board's nominating and governance committee on corporate governance issues. In both organizations, she grew the domestic and international shareholder base substantially. And now she's here on the podcast to share 5 things you didn't know about her industry. Welcome so much, Sally. Thank you so much for being on.
Oh, Angela, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be on my first podcast. I'm so lucky and thankful it's yours.
It is an honor and a privilege. I'm so lucky and grateful to have you. I know how busy you are, and my biggest wish is that we could sit here all day and talk, because I know that there's so much we can do a deep dive on, and we don't have that kind of time, unfortunately. The listeners should know that Sally was one of my grad school professors, and I learned so much during her class. And when I started this podcast, she was one of the first people that I thought of to have on as a guest, because there's still so much I don't know. And I knew that she would just be fantastic. And so thank you again for being here. And I know we can't do a big deep dive on any of these 5 things that you'll be sharing today, but still super thrilled that you can share them. So let's get to it.
Well, you touched on it earlier, but since this podcast, your podcast, is entitled 5 Things You Didn't Know, I thought that I would structure my 5 things in that way. So did you know ESG stands for environmental social governance? But more, because I know you defined that earlier, did you know that these are the tools that companies, both public and private, as well as investors use to screen for risk, as well as looking for companies that do social good? That is something that has been growing over the past really 20 years, but in particular over the past 12 to 18 months, as investors and other stakeholders have more and more focus on making sure that they screen out risk and making sure that they identify companies both from an investment standpoint, but also potential employees looking for work. Want to work for an organization that is actually doing well by doing good.
And why do you think there's been so much attention to that the last couple of months, or the last year or so, much more so than before?
I think part of it, and there have been some, it's all speculation. There have been some studies that have been done. But the bottom line is, I think most people would agree that it's really the millennial generation that is actually driving this. It's a focus very much on making sure that the companies for whom that generation works are good companies, they're in good reputational standing, But also that generation is very much looking to make their investments for retirement into assets that are viewed to be ESG, you know, good ESG assets. In other words, companies that screen well for ESG scores. So investors are also then looking, since it's demand driven, investors are actually looking to ensure that they have identified companies that have high ESG scores, meaning that you score well in the areas of environmental, social, and governance as an organization, in order to attract and retain their investor base. And so it comes primarily from two different stakeholder sets, one being the investors in an effort to differentiate themselves and to attract this new millennial generation of investors, and then also the millennial generation that's looking at it both from an investment standpoint for retirement, but also from an employer standpoint. Who do they want to work for? They want to work for a company that makes them feel good.
That makes perfect sense. And I could definitely see that. And I see that that's been a part of a lot of conversation lately in that space. And I'm wondering, does that mean that if someone's an entrepreneur, for example, is this something that they should think about working into perhaps their startup or their new business if they haven't already?
I think it depends on the size of the business. If they're looking to build a business beyond just a sole proprietorship, then yes. And even those of us that are sole proprietors, myself included, you don't want to be associated with organizations where you perceive them to be a reputational risk, because there is guilt by association. So it depends on the business perspective or the business lens that you use. If you are an entrepreneur that's looking to grow your organization and build it out, then you should be very mindful that in this age of social media, and one of the things I wanted to talk about with CEO activism is my third thing you didn't know. In this age of social media, you certainly can quickly see messages derail. And you wouldn't want that to happen to your organization. It affects your ability to employ good people, to retain good people, and it also could affect your ability to partner. And so I think those are all aspects and other stakeholders, apart from just the employees and the investors, that you need to be thinking about if you're an entrepreneur.
It's a great takeaway here that ESG is important regardless of the size of your organization. So obviously a large organization, this is something you want to have on your radar and have incorporated into your business, but also small businesses, entrepreneurs, solopreneurs can benefit from keeping ESG front of mind. Excellent stuff. What's the second thing?
Well, the second thing is still related to ESG. And did you know that more than $8 trillion, that's with a T, dollars in assets under management, it's actually $8.6 trillion to be exact, according to the U.S. Forum for Sustainable and Responsible Investment. $8 trillion in assets under management. Those are the investments managed by professional portfolio managers like Fidelity and State Street, that those have some form of ESG screening in place so that portfolio managers can identify companies that are doing good. So I touched on it on the first item that you didn't know, you might not have known, but more than $8 trillion now in assets under management from professional portfolio managers, it has some form of ESG screening in place. And it varies depending on how stringent the asset managers' guidelines are in place across the firm. Some asset managers do this according to client or customer, their customer's request. So if you as an individual investor were to invest with Fidelity, you had the opportunity to go to them. And I'm just picking Fidelity out of a hat because I think they're a well-known name, not because this is an advertisement for them. But And any organization like, any organization like that, if you go to the firm with whom you have your investment dollars and say, I'd like you to direct those investment dollars into only investing in companies that are doing well for the environment, are involved in environmental sustainability, you have the opportunity to do that in most of these firms, to varying degrees, depending on how the firms have that set up. So that has grown substantially over time. I remember when I looked at this number about 15 years ago, that was well under, under 3 million in, or three, sorry, 3 trillion in assets under management. So you can imagine how fast this has grown, and particularly over the last couple of years, as I mentioned, last really year over, as I mentioned.
That's a massive number.
It is.
And really telling of the importance of having this type of environmental social program or system in place. And how does that translate to somebody who just started investing? Or is this mostly looking at larger investors or organizations that are investing? Or does this also apply to a young investor such as myself and somebody new on the scene? I can go to, or can I go to someone and say, look, I only want to invest my money into these types of companies? Is that something that's open to the individual investor, the retail investor, or is that something that's mostly for companies or institutional investors?
No, it's a great question. And just for those in the audience who may not be familiar with the two terms that Angela is using, I'm so proud of you that you remember these. The institutional investor would be a large global asset owner. And so it would be a pension fund, for example, or somebody like this, somebody that's a professional. Think about it as a professional investor. They get paid by someone else to invest and manage money. The retail would be you and I, Angela, or our parents, or our, you know, other family members, or any individual investor. Your question's a good one, and it's exactly, I think, going back to what we talked about with, you know, this generation, this millennial generation, and now actually the boomers following suit, the baby boomer generation following suit, but the millennials leading the way and really demanding, I think, both from the standpoint of wanting to do well by do good, and that extends to their investment choices, but also, you know, their risk appetite. They want to make sure that they're very smart, and they want to make sure that, you know, what they've worked hard to gain thus far is maintained. And one of the ways to do that is to screen for risk using ESG, using environmental social governance scores. And so those are absolutely available to and used by, and you can demand it as a retail investor, an individual investor, of your wealth manager, that they only invest for you in strong ESG rated funds.
That's fantastic. So the first two are absolutely interconnected and super important. And I love that it applies to both seasoned investors and corporations, as well as individuals, and also in terms of looking at the types of, when you're thinking about launching your business, growing your business, keeping ESG in mind, I think are really important takeaways. So what is the third thing? Because I'm learning so much as well on this. So what's the third thing listeners don't know?
Well, the third thing I think that's very interesting, and there are a number of articles on this, but did you know that CEO activism is on the rise? And so traditionally, you've probably heard the word activism or activist, and you've thought of either a political activist, or you've thought of a shareholder activist if you come from my world. Well, now we have CEO activism, and we've seen this with CEOs becoming more vocal and taking more action, and becoming more active in causes. So one of when I was looking for a good example that I thought most people would resonate with most people, I thought of Tim Cook and Apple. Tim Cook has been an CEO activist in a variety of different areas, but he was very vocal in his emphasis around not wanting his nephew to use social networks and believing that boundaries are important when using technology. He believes, you know, that there could be some damage to the health of children who use social networks and who are too actively involved with technology and in social media. And so the Apple boss's statements are likely to add to a growing social concern about children's exposure. And we're talking about typically young children, children's overexposure, let's say, to social media. But it's been an interesting point of debate, and it's one that he was willing to be very vocal about. So you can Google it or DuckDuckGo it or Bing it or look it up. It's actually, there are quite a few references to his comments on the internet, but that's a good example of a CEO in this day and age taking a very vocal stance. You didn't used to see that even as recently as 5 years ago. It was rare to see CEOs really stepping up and being very vocal about different social causes, and they actually are now. So it's an interesting phenomenon and one that we watch, and there are others out there that are experts in this area watching it and writing about it very, very carefully.
How do I see that as a growing trend as well. I think that in today's day, I think CEOs are almost forced into saying something, and because not saying something is saying something. And for those CEOs that are still uncomfortable with doing that, what would be a benefit for them to do that? What would be a good incentive for them to do that when there is things at risk? Like, there's taking a stance on something puts them at risk of alienating people or certain audiences.
It absolutely does. Yeah, it absolutely does. If I were to counsel that CEO, I would say don't go there. If it's not in your comfort zone and it's not part of your makeup, and you don't feel strongly about it based on your principles, then I wouldn't do it, or I wouldn't find a cause just because you feel that other CEOs are doing it and you feel you need to get in the game. Because of exactly what you pointed out, Angela, there are a lot of downsides to taking an activist stance in any situation. I mean, political activists have, you know, there's downsides to that. There's downsides to shareholder activism. You could lose a lot of money if you're not on the winning side. So I think CEO activism definitely has strategic implications. It's got reputational implications for firms. Typically, the safer route for most CEOs is to just fall silent. But it is a new era, and social media is driving that. And we are seeing the activist CEO on the rise.
I'm definitely going to continue to follow my favorite CEOs and watch what they do. And I encourage all the listeners to keep track of the CEOs of the companies that they admire, that they buy from, to see. I think it'd be interesting to see where, you know, where they do take a stance and what they say at those moments. What is the next thing?
So the next two things actually are very related. So did you know that it is best practice today for all companies, whether you're public, private, or nonprofit, to have a crisis communications plan in place? And so by that, you can either, if you're large enough that you have an internal communications team that's familiar with doing this, that works. If you are small, that you need some outside counsel, there are wonderful firms that provide that expertise on crisis communications. It effectively looks at all of the potential scenarios that your organization could go through, and it comes up with a team, a cadence right down to who do we call. So there's a phone tree that goes into who do we call if this happens? Who do we call if that happens? What's the cadence of those phone calls? So person one alerts, person two alerts, person three alerts, person four, in those types of situations. Or it goes through each particular type of situation and in some instances identifies what the immediate response statement will be until such time that the firm or company or individual can gather more information to come up with a more fulsome response if that's necessary, which in most instances it is. And it also helps the companies think through, the organizations think through what type of a crisis committee will be pulled into place, not just the phone tree, but who actually will be needed as a cross-functional committee to talk about the different impacts on the different stakeholders. Because you may actually have one particular crisis, but that crisis could have a different impact on your customers versus your suppliers versus your investors versus your employees, et cetera, versus government regulators, et cetera, et cetera. And so you really need to have that cross-functional committee in place. So that's why that one transcends any organization, whether it's small, large, whether it's public, private, nonprofit. That's a best practice for all companies to consider.
So I could absolutely see the need for having a crisis communications plan in place, because the last moment or the worst time to come up with a plan is while the crisis is happening. So mm-hmm. I'm wondering, does a company first need to define what a crisis is? Because at what point would you implement this plan in a crisis if it's maybe not as big of a crisis? Maybe it's a problem and not a crisis. So does a company first need to define, okay, this is what crisis means in our organization?
It does, although it's a little bit like, you know, a crisis when you see it or when you're in it, certainly. And there are things that I think it's a really important point, Angela, because there are things that you may not consider to be rising to the level of a crisis that actually turn into a crisis for some reason that you didn't foresee, because there are other outside factors that affected it that turned it into the crisis that you didn't foresee. There are, in this day and age of social media, many times, you know, just one word or one tweet can turn something into a crisis, unfortunately. Right. And so then companies are left scrambling with that. And so you can't, a crisis communications plan is never meant to be complete. There's no possible way for anyone, no matter how seasoned and how excellent they are at this, to have a complete or to craft a complete crisis communications plan. But what you do want to do is have at least enough of the components of the crisis communications plan in place that you're not having to start that aspect from scratch, and you can actually move to assessing and engaging and addressing the crisis as it comes up. That's the key. And it has to be ever evolving and continual. It's a living, breathing document. It's not something that goes up on a shelf.
I'm glad you bring that up, because I think that in today's fast-paced environment, where one word can turn into a crisis on social media, means that you need to leave room for that flexibility. I think you need to be adaptable. I think you need to be able to adjust quickly to things that might turn, that might be growing, you know, for the worst, that might go in a completely different direction. So I love that idea that this crisis communications plan is a living document and not, you know, something you put together and then it's stored in a file somewhere and then you double click on it when something bad's about, you know, is going down, and you can open that and say, okay, let's follow these steps. I like this thought that it's something that is living and breathing that you need to modify and adjust and go along with as this crisis is unfolding. And but at least you have this foundation there, right? Like the essence of this plan, the broad steps of action that need to be taken, and then you adjust as you go along.
Exactly.
I think that's really powerful.
That's exactly right.
I think a lot of times people think of plans as these very rigid things, like this is the plan, we must stick to the plan, but the plan might not have that nuance in there for something that comes along in a crisis situation. You can't foresee everything, right?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. And that's one of the reasons why it's critical that it be a living, breathing document and it not just be, you know, an exercise that's done even once a year. There needs to be somebody that's in charge of it and somebody that is constantly thinking about the impacts of what could happen. The world has gotten very fast paced, and it's critical to make sure that your contacts are updated, your cross-functional committee is still the committee. Nobody hasn't left, you know, there isn't somebody that's left the organization, and then you've got a hole to fill. And that's why it's just a constant living, breathing document that needs nurturing.
I love that. And I think it makes sense for established businesses, but also for somebody who might just be starting out to think about, okay, crisis can happen in all stages of an organization.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you said the fifth thing ties into this most recent point, and what's that?
Yes. So did you know that there is a quote-unquote golden window of time after a crisis happens when a company can respond? It's called the golden hour of crisis management. That window is usually an hour, as I just said, and although it sometimes can last a little longer, it just depends on the situation. There is a gentleman, Martin Alderton, founder and CEO of the company Clarity Stress and Trauma. He's done quite a bit of research into the topic. And what he found is that after that golden window closes, that fear, resentment, and bitterness for the victims starts to set in by the public. And then the longer that goes on without the company that is involved in the crisis responding or making a public statement, the harder it is to actually turn the public's opinion of that company. And the more reputational damage is done to the company. So it's an interesting study that he's done. You can find his information. He's out of the UK and he's been broadly quoted. But it's very, very important, again, going back to the crisis communications plan, to have that in place so that you can alleviate time or mitigate time getting to whatever your initial response statement is going to be. Every minute counts in a crisis.
When you said 1 hour, I just felt my heart beat faster, and I'm not in a crisis mode
yes.
right now. That's not a lot of time. I mean, honestly, that's
it is not.
That's nothing. I mean, by the time, that's a bit scary actually. That's all you have in terms of putting something out there. Now, does acknowledging that there's something going on and saying that you are, because that's what I feel like I see sometimes. And I just, you know, I wondered, mm-hmm. is this a good way to get started? Is when you don't have the slightest idea of what's going on, is a response to say, this is going on. We know it. We are aware of it. We have the team on it. We are figuring out exactly how this whole thing came about, and we will update you. Is that enough of a response to push out in that first hour if you have absolutely no idea where to begin and you just are panicking and it feels like the world's coming apart? Is that sufficient, or do you spend, you know, the first 30 minutes crafting a better response and then putting it out some point before that hour is up?
Yeah, it really depends on the crisis. And so it's a fine line that you're having to draw as an organization because it absolutely does depend on the crisis. It's a different situation if an individual tweets about your company and the tweet goes viral, and it may or may not be accurate, but you need to take the time to address it. That could be theoretically a quote-unquote crisis, but it's more, you know, an individual just disparaging the organization. Let's say that there was nothing to the tweet and it was a false tweet. There you're probably better holding off on commenting in that situation. Again, dependent on the situation, but I'm talking about gross generalities right now. Whereas, you know, picture that you're a bank and there's an armed robbery and hostages, and it goes on for hours, and it starts to be covered by the local news and then the national news, and your bank name is all over the place, and then there's a shootout and there are victims, and the organization stays silent through the whole thing. Even though it wasn't the bank's fault, it was an armed robbery, you can imagine that if the organization has no statement whatsoever for a period of hours, where, and we've seen this, where the public starts to turn on the bank. Well, why weren't your security, you know, security policies better, procedures better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it really depends on the situation, but in general, the studies that he's done say you should put out something within that golden window, which typically is around an hour, even if it's just to say, we're aware of it, we're working with the authorities, we'll provide more information as soon as we can.
Wonderful. Sally, thank you so much for sharing these five things. They're absolutely interesting and fascinating. I had no idea. And I think our listeners will take away a lot from this conversation. Really, really valuable.
Thank you, Angela, for having me. And I hope everybody has learned a little something. I always learn something when we have these conversations. So I very much appreciate you asking me.
Me too. And I really appreciate you coming on the show. It's such an honor and truly a privilege, especially early on in my journey on podcasting. And so I really appreciate to have you, because I know you are a woman in demand.
Well, you are off to a great start, and I think you have a serious career as a podcaster in front of you, among other things.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I love bringing, you know, industry leaders to the forefront and learning from them and then sharing that experience with others. And this has very much been a wonderful experience. So thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in again with myself and my guest this week, Sally Curley from Curley Global IR. It's been absolutely wonderful. Make sure to tune in next week. I have another exciting guest. Truly appreciate it. Check you then. Thank you. Bye.